The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I have a hard time with the proper definition of my next guest in terms of her job title. It's Angela Aiello. It's super wine girl. It's wine expert, educator, innovator, entrepreneur. Did I mention winemaker? If I didn't, congrats on making wine here at the Crush Studios. Angela, it's been way too long. Thanks for being on the pod.
Oh, my pleasure. I love having great conversation with good people. And we're going to have some good wine. So
yes,
makes
yes.
sense to me.
You're a little biased because it's your wine.
Yes.
But I'm excited to try it. I'm excited to talk all more about Crush. When I've had Graham on the podcast before, we talked about it. This, to me, is maybe the best wine bar in Ontario. Certainly for if you want to get to know what Ontario is about, there's no better place than here. Flat out. And I mean, I love Archive, and there's a bunch of great wine bars, most of them on Dundas, it seems, in Toronto. But this place is truly special. But I want to start here in a different place. What would your life be like if your to-do list was completed and there was nothing else to do?
Honestly, I think I'd be on a beach for a while doing nothing but suntanning and being in the water, doing a little bit of gardening, listening to some jazz and drinking Barolo on my, you know, beautiful couch with a fireplace. That's the dream day right there.
How long could you do that before you would get bored?
Yeah, that's a great question, because if you look at my history, I tend to want to do everything. And I think that that's part of the joy of life, is you can actually just be disciplined enough to change your career a million times. I mean, my career has been steady in a way where it has been mostly wine for the last two decades, but it's been every part of the business.
Yeah.
So it's I have a curiosity to learn. And so you're right. How long can I sit still? You know what? We should test it out and see what happens.
See how long you could go with that.
Yeah.
And I appreciated you started with beach. Yeah. Then you said Barolo, but then you quickly said by the fire.
Yes.
Because I was thinking, Barolo, maybe not the best, awesome wine, maybe not the best beach wine.
100%. I mean, I'm definitely drinking rosé on the beach.
Yes.
That those two things definitely go together.
Well, you started, you know, the Aiello School. That's talked about the last time we did the pod. I started to learn. Some of my first wine classes was with you at Red's in downtown Toronto.
Years
That's how
ago.
Long ago it's been.
I know. I mean, we have a home base of Toronto. We love Niagara. We love wine. And it's true. I started the wine club originally back in 2006 when I moved to Toronto. And then back, I think it was book 20, maybe even like 12, 11, 12. It was, yeah, wine school. And then it was the wine cave. And now it's a winery.
What would you define your, I guess you can't really define yourself by one job.
Yes, I know. I think that's part of the problem. A Jill of all trades maybe is a compound like that. But I do find, like, I'm curious. I'm a curious person. And so I think when I think about my talents, as I'm getting older, I turned 44 this year. I'm not a spring chicken anymore. But like, you start to hone in on the things you really like to do, knowing you can do a lot of things and then honing in on those really, like, you know, things that make you feel good, that bring you joy.
I've said over and over again, almost everyone I've ever interviewed, every winemaker, every winery owner, there's some things they all share in common. One, a distaste for profit and money. But another would be is curiosity. I mean, that's the thing about wine. Why does this wine taste like this? Yeah. Why is it the same grapes from the same area, and yet that the next year it tastes different? I think that might be the core for so many of us, is the curiosity factor.
I agree. The personality trait that draws us all in is this curiosity for so many parts of the business, right? And I think it's interesting, though, the commercial side of the business you bring up. You know, it's not, usually they say what it takes to, it takes a million, it takes 2 million to make a million in the business. And maybe I'm just a stubborn tourist, but I think, you know, when I hear that, I'm like, man, there's got to be a better way. And you know what? When I met Graham Rennie, it really helped kind of open my eyes to what it was available to possibly me to find a different way in the business to define it, commercially speaking.
Yeah, because you should be able to work in wine and pay your mortgage. I think that's a very fair compromise.
Mm-hmm. And when we look about sustainability, so if anything the last 5 years has taught me, it's like supply chain is important to final product. That's what it's taught all of us, actually. I think the pandemic really taught us that supply chain, when there's disruptions in supply chain, everybody kind of feels it in different ways. We're feeling that right now with the tariffs, et cetera, et cetera. When you look at the supply chain, you have to think about the whole picture of wine, not just the, does this wine taste good? Is it white or red? Does it cost this amount? Do you know how many decisions go into making a bottle of wine to the final end? It's insane how many.
How many years now have you been making wine?
So this is our second vintage.
Second vintage.
Yeah.
By the way, what is the name of the winery again for people that are looking it up?
Yes. Yeah, so it's the Juice Wine Company. But this collection, which we looked at more like a fashion release, is our spring collection, our gold leaf collection. Because you'll see, obviously, we don't have the gold leaf here because the Chardonnay is pretty well sold out. But we have our other leaf collection here. So this is our spring collection.
The Juice Wine Company. Be very easy for someone to Google if they wanted to Google it right now as they're listening to this. So circling back after that shameless plug for you. What are some of the decisions people don't realize that have to get made when it comes to releasing a bottle of wine?
Well, I think the most important for us was, you know, making sure that the quality juice, which we already knew in our head, obviously, we are going to make great juice. We're going to make exceptional juice. That was our vision. But then the next vision is, how does this juice talk to people? And I think if you look at the theme of my entire career, it's really about meeting people where they are and understanding how to communicate with people. And I think wine has done an incredibly bad job of communicating with people. They communicate with maybe small little cult-ish followings. But really, and this lends itself also now to the commercial side of the business, when you talk to more people in a way that they can resonate with, then the success of your company is just a natural solution. It's the end result. So the creative. So I said the pursuit of perfection is in the winemaker's art inside the glass, but looking at a bottle and knowing, oh my gosh, that speaks to me. I love it. I'm learning about ampelography, the art of wine, by looking at the leaves. This is a Riesling leaf. This is a Cab Franc leaf, but also the hand-dipped, hand-tone matching wax that goes on top of the bottle, which we've spent hours and hours and hours doing. So when you look at I really wanted our wines to almost feel like a piece of jewelry. So you kind of looked at it and go, wow, that's really beautiful. You know, the way you look at other very expensive things in life or other beautiful things in life. And then most of the information is actually on the back of our label. You see, obviously, our tagline, our picture of our family, the fact that we give back to a national not-for-profit, a cute tasting note, which guided us in how we were making this wine. So in a way, we focused on two things, the juice and then the optical you drink with your eyes magic of a bottle of wine.
And it's true. You so do. I mean, it's not just about the senses of how much acidity you are getting on the wine. Your pleasure is really comes. It's really the entire package, including the packaging. All right, we'll get back to just you deciding to get into wine, making your wine. And also, we're going to try a couple of them here.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the work you're doing right now for the Crush? And I just call it the Crush, but Custom Crush on King. What is the proper title? Just I've been here a bunch, but probably mangle it every time.
I mean, I think the Crush is the easiest way we want everybody to think about it. You can call it the Crush. That's really where it's at. And it mean obviously it means two things. We're a two-fold business. We work with the commercial side of the business to help produce really great wines from other wineries that they can't produce on site because they don't have the production. So we have that commercial ability. But then we also are an artisan studio for collaborative winemakers. And I think that's really only like a very small portion of the business. Let's say 5% of the business is the artisan part and 95% is the commercial part. But you know, when Graham originally approached me and wanted to sort of told me about his idea, this is not the first time I've seen this concept in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Canada's last to it. Unfortunately, Oregon has it, Washington has it, everywhere else has garage yeast that you share production sites and you build it like an art, right? Because wine is a cross-section of science and art. So that really is also, I think, part of it. But we are a collective of independent winemakers all under one roof. The Crush on King is sort of our newly refreshed mission of bringing people to the tasting room. We reside in one of the oldest wineries in the region, Stony Ridge. Back in the 80s, it was one of the foundational wineries to earn, you know, a winery certificate, a manufacturing certificate. So we reside in a heritage house. And I think that's also very interesting, taking one of Canada's newest, you know, ideas to us anyways, not in the world, but and bringing it to Niagara in one of an old space. So you have this sort of nod to heritage as well, but also this sort of modern take on how can you, with a small fortune, still start a winery.
Well, yeah, because this place is a haven, a sanctuary for people that are passionate about wine, who know how to make wine, but don't have the money to own their own press, to own their own stainless steel, to not have all the equipment, which is incredibly expensive. And you've got to have the real estate to have it, to yes. place it somewhere. So that, I mean, to me, when I think of this place, it's a twofold thing. It's one, it's about letting winemakers make the wine they want to make. And then two, helping them sell it and expose these small, tiny little micro wineries to the public. That to me is the two-pronged thing of this place.
Definitely. When you walk in, you can taste wine from a dozen small independent producers. So there's like 22 wines on our wine list right now from 8 different producers. We have another 7 SKUs coming from Adam, who's going to be, Adam Curran's going to be coming into our tasting room soon enough. And so we're giving the opportunity for basically artists to showcase their art. And so the refreshing of the tasting room, this rebrand that we're right in right now, I mean, we soft launched it last weekend. The Crush on King is the name of what we're calling this tasting room, wine bar, and garden experience. So we're really trying to refresh the whole experience when you land on property.
It's so cool. I love just coming in here and looking at the wine list. And there's minimum 15, I think I'm underselling it, wines by the glass. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it's going to change all the time. And I would so recommend, and I know it feels like I'm doing an infomercial. I don't get paid by anyone here. Graham did once give me half a bottle of one of his cabs last time I interviewed him, more than enough for me. But I love the fact that this place exposes, because it's so hard for someone who wants to learn about Ontario wine to try so many different ones. The LCBO, they're doing a much better job. We enjoy the LCBO more now than we did many years ago, but we still have problems. Anyway, they allow for a certain amount.
Yes.
And then there's people got to drive around, and you've got to be able to do the work. Here it kind of takes a little bit of the work away.
Yes.
And also there's a lot of places, there is no bricks and mortar to try a bunch of these wines. You can't drive to Niagara-on-the-Lake and go into their tasting room because they don't have a tasting room because they can't afford one because that's expensive.
No, you bring up a great point. Other wineries, you walk in, you try wines from that domain, that house, that chateau, whatever it might be. Here you come here and you really do experience art in its many formats through various different artists. So you have the ability to come in and try wines from 8 different winemakers, different styles, different resonance, different vintages, all terroir driven. Most of them are single vineyard wines. So the part about this new wine bar concept that we're rolling with is the fact that, you know, you are not trying entry level wines. Our wines are above $30. We have winemakers that touch every single bottle of that wine. So you're coming in and really you're sampling art, but you're really also learning about the person. So our winemakers in residence is really important too, bringing out those faces of people. I mean, I am lucky because I've spent the last 20 years branding my face and who I am. So the sales part's a little easier for me because I've learned how to optimize the sales channel a little bit and have a great following, people who love wine. That's very lucky. This was a natural kind of like, of course I'm going to make wine. Everyone's been asking me, when am I going to own my own winery? When am I going to make wine? So if everybody's asking for it, I mean, likelihood, I should probably do something about it.
I'm going to correct you on one small thing.
Yeah.
You used the word lucky twice. That's not lucky. You worked so hard. And I think there's always a negative impression that people don't know about the word influencer. The reason is there's a lot of bad faith characters and actors out there who are not good influencers. And there's a lot of influencers where it feels like they've been propped up. The real ones, the ones that have been doing it for a long time, it takes a ton of work. You know, most people I follow on Instagram, including yourself, I know how much work that goes into it. But the people that don't, how hard was it for you to get out there where you are a recognizable face and name?
I mean, I think no matter what industry you're in, you have to build yourself a reputation. And those things take complete honesty, authenticity, and trust. You're building an audience. You're not just like being a showman on a show, right? This is about really building an audience. And so when you connect with people, and that goes back to segueing to how do you connect your wine to people? That is probably the most important thing. How do I make what I do a part of your life? How do I make this product be a mirror for you? Or for you to and just enhance your curiosity, because that's what wine is supposed to do too. So, I mean, it is true. I guess I say I'm lucky, but I have been working hard for most of my life, which is why maybe the beach and the fire and the everything's the relaxation part of life is really tuning to me. I've unfortunately been very disciplined in my job, and my job has been 20 years of most of the same thing. Even though I've had other career like opportunities in there, I've really worked hard in the wine business to build a reputation for myself that has great value. And I think also value to the industry of what I'm trying to help trailblaze through the world, if that makes any sense.
Well, no, you've played a big part in helping, you know, Canadians, Ontario first, and then obviously it's expanded because people can find you in any part of the world. But you've played a part in helping to normalize and make wine less intimidating, you know, for two decades. The last time you were on was December, this was episode 82. This is going to be around episode 256, December 20th, 2020. From a wine perspective, COVID, bottle shops, pop-ups, people being allowed to sell wine, and then that weird period where you have to buy food and here's some truffle ruffle chips, you know, tariffs, more focus on local, the LCBO. And it's funny, some of the LCBOs, they didn't know what to do. So I've seen it where they would have leaning posts, and then two rows over, they'd have leaning posts again. You could have, anyway, you could put it together. Yes. So, I mean, that's some of the things that's changed in wine. An impossible question for you to answer. What are just some of the biggest changes, projects that's gone on in your life since the last time we chatted?
Well, the economic change in the last 6 years has been incredible. So it's impacted everybody differently economically. Personally, I had a baby, which is great. I found a great man who's a winemaker also. So we pontificate about wine all the time. And then we have had a baby. We're only going to have one. He's Luca, my son. He's 2.5. That's a big deal. I also merged my business back in 2019, right before COVID, and became a sort of a solo entrepreneur in COVID. So that was also a very interesting shift business-wise. So now it's sort of like, honestly, I've worked a really long time kind of with teams, and I consider myself a very big team player. It's always a hard place to be because you lead on up and down and all around. But I do feel like it's nice to be back at the Crush, helping with this refresh and having a team, because I think that's part of like really what brings joy is working with a team.
How long have you been here for?
So we made our wine in 2004, and then
2004
vintage.
I thought this is new. What do you mean 2004?
I know.
Google fail me?
2004 was our first vintage. So then it didn't release to 05. Mm-hmm. So we're making wines that I'm calling sort of ready to drink. These wines you could age for years as well, but I'm like ready to drink business is where we're at in wine. I always consider a wine bottle a single serving. But anyways, that was 04. Then last year was 05. We launched in June. We
you
sold
mean
out
24 and 25.
Yeah, what did I say? 2004. Oh my gosh, 2024 is what I meant.
In
I'm missing
my brain,
a two there.
I'm like, wait a minute.
Like, what is she talking about?
24 and 25. Yeah, because.
Yeah, sorry. 24 and 25. Yeah. My bad. But so the last 2 years, basically, for vintages. Yeah.
What are we going to try? We'll put the mics down in a second. But before we throw the mics down, what is the first wine that you are pouring for me? Obviously, this is a rosé of some sort. You know, I'm just going to vamp. I'll just talk as Angela's pouring it because you can do that really quick. You didn't have to, you know, suddenly open with a corkscrew. So what do we got here?
Good. That's still good. Okay, good. That was, there's no date on the bottle, but rosé, I never thought, I mean, I did, you know, through the all the metrics of wine that rosé and bubbles are the top trending wine. We made a Chardonnay, a Rosé, a Gamay, and a Cab Franc as our first SKU. We didn't start with like one wine and kind of make more. We started with four and now we have five. So we really kind of just went in head first and really developed like a portfolio of family. And the Rosé seems to be our star child. And I'm not surprised because we made about 39 cases last year. We sold out in 3 weeks.
Congratulations.
So that was really awesome. It was kind of just one of those things. It's like, oh man, now I don't even have rosé to drink on the beach in August in Canada. So we made 300 cases this year, 56 of which are going to the LCBO on June 6th for an LCBO Vintages launch.
Very nice.
Very exciting.
How cool is that going to be for you, for someone who's worked in wine in every different capacity, seeing your wine at the LCBO? Because we're always going to have an up and down relationship with it, like we have the same up and down relationship with our cable provider and our cell phone provider. That's life.
It's confusing.
But I mean, that must be an honor when you say, hey, that's my wine at the LCBO.
I feel very proud, and I feel generally speaking, you know, when we gave it to the LCBO, we had a Zoom call with them, they tasted it. One of the things we did with this wine is we made it a single vineyard rosé. So, I mean, when you actually look at the world of rosé,
that's rare.
It's very rare. We didn't even think about it, actually, as we were designing the labels. I'm like, we're like, is this a single vineyard? And it was a single vineyard. We were lucky enough to get a single vineyard fruit, especially for also 300 cases. So, you know, now fruit is scarce right now because luckily local is on fire, but that also lends itself to supply chain issues. So now we're dealing with a different issue, which is not enough fruit for everybody that wants to make wine.
Of what vineyard does this this Cap Franc? Is this 100% Cap Franc?
It's 100% Cap Franc.
100% Cap Franc rosé. Yeah. What?
8 hours on skins.
8 hours on skins.
So it's a super light. Obviously, it's Provençal. Not obviously, but it is Provençal inspired.
It's a beautiful color.
It's gorgeous. And honestly, one of the biggest things we pushed our winemakers to do was the color. So color was very, very, very important to us. And you know what? How many times I've had a conversation with a winemaker that says color is the hardest thing to manufacture perfectly, especially in a rosé. And so now we're talking creatively with winemakers about how to change color and not make it so hard, or, you know, make it a bit more of an easier job on the winemaking side, but never losing the integrity of the juice.
It's funny. I was talking with the gentleman at King & Vic recently, and it's one thing I brought up. It seems that color is important with white, with red, with rosé, with bubbles, with all of it. But I feel if I had to pick one style of wine where color, for whatever reason, seems to be the most important, or at the very least I respond to more, it's rosé. I don't know why, but the color of rosé I focus on more than I would on your Chardonnay or your red.
I mean, pink is a beautiful color. And there's many shades of it.
Yeah.
And people have preferences. And that's the other thing about what we talk about talking to people. People have preferences. I mean, and when you look historically, if you're a wine person and you look at the historical, you know, story of pink, that's an interesting story. That could pontificate a whole podcast about the, you know, proliferation of pink. And I think at the end of the day, you've got Rosado, you know, you have Taval, you have those full bodied reds that kind of are very punchy in color. You know, they're almost neon. This is exactly opposite. It's a little softer. Obviously, it's between salmon and maybe like Jolly Rancher, like it's somewhere in there. But there's also, we've also complicated the winemaking a little bit more because we've added 10% of barrel, neutral barrel on this wine. So there's texture and weight on the palate. So for me, rosé is a, also should be a complicated wine. So when you look at the winemaking, it adds more detail into how are you sort of shifting, what are the grapes? How are we winemaking them? And then what is the winemaking process after? It is stainless steel, most of it. But then we've added that little bit of added texture for neutral barrel, which I really, really like because it extends the everything of the palate of the wine.
So you kind of are going against the normal grain of a lot of rosé that we see. Single vineyard, also single grape. You don't often get Cab Franc. And there is some old there's some old wood going on in this one as well.
Yeah.
No, that's great. What
it's different than a lot of rosés. I think a lot of people think about their rosés, but maybe they it's not their raison d'être. Mm-hmm. It's not their house wine. It's not. So I think rosé is now going to become kind of who we are. It's defining our image, our brand, who we work with. But our other, you know, it's not just the star child, to be honest. I'm one of four sisters. We're all star children. So if I talk about my wines, the next wine we're going to talk about is a St. Urban Riesling, which has as lengthy of an awesome story as the Wismer Cuesta rosé. So
that answered my other question. Yeah. Wismer, I can never pronounce Wismer. People have heard me say this for ages. If Wismer is on the bottle, at the very least, you have a very high floor in terms of quality. But your Wismer
Cuesta.
Cuesta, yeah. Yes. All right. And that's a good vineyard.
Yeah.
That is a very well-known vineyard for the wine geeks in Niagara.
Well, and if you are a VQA wine geek, which so many of us are, if you grew up in it or you've just are a wine person, you kind of get to know all of these great angles of the business, and they're all people, right? This is the other thing about wine. It's like, okay, we have great fruit, but it's about the humans. The humans of wine are very important, and I think that's also part of connection in general as well. I mean, this rosé tastes delicious.
Juicy, good, solid, mid. Here would be the best thing I put it is that often rosé is the drink. Oh, I'll just have a glass of rosé. And you're having it because you're on a patio, mm-hmm. not because you want to enjoy rosé. This one is sort of the elevated. Mm-hmm. I'm having this rosé not because of my geography, but because I enjoy what's going on in the glass.
100%. I couldn't have said it better myself. So that's interesting where you put rosé in your life. Mm-hmm. And for, I guess, when you start to really drink a lot of, I drink a lot of white wine and rosé, to be honest. I'm a Chardonnay drinker, and then I'm a rosé drinker next. And then you've got Riesling, and then you've got Pinot Noir, and then you've got Gamay, and then you've got Cab Franc. Those are my order of what I drink. Mm-hmm. And then Barolo, obviously.
Yes, of course.
And obviously, there's the Big B's are always in there, but they're after the end. Yeah. Talk about the regions later. You know, this, I love the palate of this. This is completely dry. I think it's 1 gram of sugar. It's beautifully made wine. And I think the other thing is, too, like, so Ryan's a winemaker, and then also we work with Adam and the team at The Crush. So this collaboration part of the business is also really important. Graham's really done a great job at putting a team together that can help us, all of us, achieve our dreams. You know, we sit down with Adam right now and say, this is what we're trying to make for the season. Where do we find our fruit? What does this mean for winemaking? You know, are we adding any extra SKUs next year? And it's kind of a, summer is the time to be creative, which is great because the sun is shining and it's the perfect season. It's busy season. So that's when we're planning for next season's portfolio and what the collection's going to look like.
You've mentioned twice now finding fruit. And before you said, why is it so difficult right now getting the proper fruit that you need?
Well, there's been some political changes that basically you get a government rebate if you make a certain amount of wine up to a certain point. But that now that cap has been removed. So now the government is actually, which is amazing on one end, once again, supply chain, they're funding the promotion and the growth of VQA wines. But what that also means is, you know, a lot of the grape growers have made commitments to bigger companies. So we're sourcing fruit from small little vineyards. And if people already have handshake deals, I mean, this business is still an old business in a way, right? Where if you have a handshake deal with grower A for a few years and you can't really give it away to somebody else. So you're kind of finding people with either extra fruit or maybe vineyards that are in transitional hands right now, if that makes any sense. It's kind of like your grape, which is why we're so lucky, because when you get grapefruit, it's not as easy as, I guess, it's not as easy now. Mm-hmm. You know, when we first got into the business, there were Grand Cru vineyards in Ontario dying to sell their fruit because nobody was buying.
Yeah.
But then the lift on the rebate went out, and now, you know, everybody's got a lot of people interested in buying a lot of fruit. So the supply and demand part of the chain is also very interesting. And a shift no one could have predicted. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of the theme of making wine. It's unpredictable, whether it comes to weather, economic forces, or politics. But I will say, good for you for your sourcing, because Saint Urbain, which is the vineyard for your Riesling, very well-known one, and that's been an area that has produced a lot of great Riesling.
You know, I'm very lucky. I grew up in the Benchlands. I grew up at Highway and Victoria here, mm-hmm. and I drove to Vineland for 5 years of my life, between 16 and 21, and I worked in the restaurant, in retail sometimes. We were like working banquets, weddings, whatever it was. For 5 years, I worked at Vineland during very impressionable years of my life, 16 to 21. And those were, I mean, a great time in wine. I talking about the growth in wine when there was really no mobile phones even available. It's a different time to be in tourism. But I obviously, I made great uncles. I call them my wine uncles, Brian and Alan. And they're still there to this day. And we love each other. And, you know, when I told them we were making wine, I went and tasted our first vintage with them. And we didn't make wine first vintage. We didn't make Riesling first vintage. Because I said, if I'm going to make Riesling, I'm not going to make a bad one. So, you know, there's really only one place for me, and it's the St. Urban Vineyard, because that's where I drove down every single day. That what's fundamentally is a bookend to my story. Anyways, I tasted the wines with Brian and Alan, and sort of like cheekily said, like, oh, would you ever sell me some fruit, little old Ange, you know? And Brian just put his arm around me and said, you'd probably be the only person in the world we'd sell this to.
Oh, that's awesome.
An amazing story. So it's really not a thing. It is actually now just a thing right now. Paul Pender did do a little bit of work with the St. Vineyard vineyard back in the day, but he wasn't able to label it the St. Urban Vineyard, which is also a great homage, if you will.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a Grand Cru vineyard, 40-year-old vines mixed in and out of some youthful ones.
What are the specs behind this in terms of...
8 grams.
8 grams, yeah.
And 9 grams, yeah.
And once again, everyone out there, don't fear sugar, residual sugar when it comes to Riesling. The Chilean cab that you had has more sugar in it than what we have in our glass right now. So do not fear the sugar. What do people need to know about this Riesling?
I mean, the winemaking is fairly simple in that we got 1 ton of fruit from, you know, I just said, Brian, obviously pick whenever you want, which he did. So a winemaker picked the fruit when he...
You're not consulting on no, pruning or picking.
Absolutely not. I'm just like, whatever you think is great. You know, it was brought over from Vineland to the Crush. So it's fermented up to as far as we could possibly push it, I think, because because I just said dry to the winemaking team. And this is sort of where we landed at. It's stainless steel. There's really no super complication in the winemaking. I really wanted the fruit on this to show. Also, I wanted it to be, it's so funny because we had a couple people come into the winery the other day. I gave them a glass of the rosé, but they ended up buying the Riesling. So this is a wine, even if you know nothing about, 40-year-old vines or drying or sugar, when you taste this wine, it's just a dream in a glass. And this was my very first wine when I was probably 18 years old. You know, my parents were away. I bring a bottle of wine home. This was probably the wine that I had in 1998 or something like that.
I love the fact that for a lot of people, that when they're sneaking booze, they'll just go in their parents' liquor cabinet and take rum and vodka and mix it with Fanta. But for you, you were taking high-end Riesling.
Yeah. I guess I started with good juice.
Yeah.
So this is my wine, I guess, in a way. So this is, I was very excited and happy to release this. There's only 90 cases. I think we're half sold out already. We just launched these wines, I guess March 15th, even March 30th. So what, a month and a bit, 6 weeks. This is a wonderful food wine. And many of our wines are actually now getting on a lot of lists in Toronto. We have our wines even at Canoe and some of Bymark, Abriel. The Rosé is going to go by the glass at Abriel. So we've got some amazing Toronto partners that have also really helped with selling of the wine. Most people make wine and then can't sell it. Or, we make wine and we're selling it about the same rate that we could make it, I think.
How different are the wine lists now in downtown Toronto versus 20 years ago? Because I feel when you got started, if you had finished doing a course at iYellow and then you made the quick walk and went up to Canoe in the TD Tower, I imagine their wine list would probably not have this style of wine. And by style, I just mean small, independent Niagara producer making Riesling.
I definitely think 20 years ago, for sure, wine country was still just a little nugget of awesomeness. And so when you look at the Toronto market being, basically a enlarged version, it's like VQA was probably not on the list 20 years ago. If it were, it was by the bottle. You might be lucky to get it by the glass. Now it has completely shifted. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. All of those high-end restaurants are really VQA proud. And that has something to do, I think, maybe with the generation that's taking over the menu and the wine list. 20 years ago, those people were taught that Canada wasn't even a winemaking place. So why would you be holding wines, at the CN Tower that say a sense of place of this is Canada? We've defined ourselves now. And thankfully to so many legends in our business, there are many people that have helped build this whole business. They've been here 40 years. I think it's Brian Schmitz. I won't tell him, but 36th year of making wine. It's just these people have defined it consistently over time. And then when you go back to my, have you been lucky? It's no, there's a reputation that we're creating. There's a reputation Ontario winemakers have been creating for 20 years. The batch elders, the people who are batch elder who's going around talking about Grand Cru Gamay according to elevation and where that is. We have people that are experts in our field finally coming out. And so we're sharing that education, which is important in growth.
Nice for Thomas to finally come out and speak. He's a very shy man, so
yeah.
Good for him for breaking out of his shell. By the way, a fantastic Riesling.
Thank you.
Anyone who's in wine, we all love Riesling. Yeah. It's been said 1,000 times, but this is great. This is a really nice expression. This is 25?
This is 25, and another really interesting story about just Riesling in general is that Ryan made wine in the Mosel. Mm-hmm. So he was there for a whole vintage when he was getting his Niagara College diploma, and so it's really we have Riesling stories. We drink wine from the Mosel. We drink Grand Cru Riesling. I love VDP Riesling. It's one of my favorite things to splurge on as well. When you're having food is that Grand Cru Riesling.
On the day of my 48th birthday, I was in Marcus Molitor. So,
there you go.
We are in full agreement.
Yes.
By the way, what do you two bicker about more? Winemaking decisions or parenting decisions?
That's interesting. Now it's getting into a bit more of the winemaking side. Started off. Actually, we don't really argue too much about parenting.
You said that's interesting. Is that code for shut the fuck up? That's too personal.
No, but I think I think as we are getting more particular, like when we first got into winemaking, we were kind of like, we were just jumping in, so excited. It's easy because you're making big decisions, but they end up being, you know, small decisions at the end. And so now this year we're in year three and it's kind of like, oh my God, oh my God. So there's a lot of, yeah, boardroom talk all the time around, around what we are going to do for the next vintage and how and whatever. But yeah, between me, Adam, and Ryan, we all have similar wine outlooks maybe. So it is actually a nice common table to be around when you're making wine, because like each person will have their opinion, but you know, we y'all kind of agree some, we most of the time we agree on everything.
Good. And listen, yeah. I don't mind that. I don't need you know, false stories of of anger and fighting just to try to gin it up. By the way, I should say, if you see Adam Kern's wines, anyone listening, he's very good at what he does. I remember I tried his wines about a year or so ago. Andre Preux was doing a rosé release, and I was interviewing him for the pod, and Adam was there, and I tried. And of course, he's like a lot of classic winemakers. I've emailed him a couple times. He hasn't got back to me. Yeah. Adam, it's
the email train isn't there. Yeah.
Adam, it's 9:45 on May 12th, if you want to respond. But don't worry, I never take it personal. I know how busy winemakers are, and to me, there's a real ego if everyone takes everything personally.
It's
never an attack. Never an attack on you. Totally off topic. Hardest part of doing live TV hits, trying to go through five or six wines when you're on to talk about what to have on Mother's Day or what to have this spring. Like, that is, for people just watching it idly, like, oh, okay. As someone who's worked in that business for a long time, you're juggling a lot, especially on live TV.
Yeah, you know, I'm on CB24 again this week as well, and it's brunch wines. But we're talking about Winefest Toronto. So it's kind of like, what are we drinking at brunch? When is brunch? It's 12 to 2. What are those types? What's happening? But it is like finding one of those catchy themes and then pulling like really detailed information underneath is kind of a creative part of it. But I think, you know, wine, we talked earlier about how wine fits into your lifestyle. And this is where you really have to like open your brain, because wine does fit into a part of your life. Rosé fits into your patio. When you're sitting on the patio, that's rosé. When you're sitting down eating risotto, what are you drinking?
You know, maybe a little Nebbiolo.
Exactly. When you're sitting there and you're maybe on the beach, it's rosé.
Yes.
When you're sitting there, maybe you're in your garden. You know how many people, I know so many women who drink Sauvignon Blanc when they're gardening. That's like the lifestyle, right?
The herbaceousness of it, you know. That's the place for the Marlboro, often attacked and slagged Sauvignon Blanc. When you're now, personally, I might do the white Bordeaux, get a little Simeon there, but that's a topic for another day.
I you know what I just saw today was I think there's a Bordeaux producer making Blanc de Noir from Gamay, from Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon. There's red varietals in it, and it's a white wine coming out of Bordeaux.
Are they making it in the land of Bordeaux? Because I feel the wine police would arrest them.
Right?
Because they probably broke about seven laws doing
exactly,
that.
Exactly. I agree. Oh, those European laws. Yeah. They like take forever to change.
There's like a 29-year-old winemaker in Burgundy going, wait a minute, we can do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like I think packaging. So this comes back to like just putting a creative wrapper on what we're trying to, you know, sell is the most economical way to say it, but really you're trying to share a lifestyle. And so when you do TV, what's the hardest part of live TV is putting like really detailed, complicated items into like more of a generic theme, and then trying to get people to emotionally attach to whatever's, you know, on screen or that you're trying to talk to. But
and then trying to do that in 4 minutes and 28
seconds.
Right,
and dumbing down to 10 seconds.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then you've got 28 seconds for this one. And sometimes there's a new host and they're like, hey, look at me, and they're doing like just there's all that, and you're trying to get through all the wines, and is everything poured, and is it, does it look good?
Yeah,
it's hard doing live.
Oh man, I've made some mistakes too. I'll tell you, I don't ever want to talk about them, but you know, on live TV, I've made some super bloopers, and it's like those are really hard to live with. Even if there's only a handful of them, you're like, oh, did I just say that? Like, did I say 2004 instead of 2024?
You're not beating yourself up over that.
No, that was 30 minutes ago. Yeah, exactly.
But for one second,
live TV is a little different. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. And it's just, you know, and yeah, it's the pressure, because you know, if you make a mistake, well, it's live TV. It's all going on there. And also, you're trying to give all this important information, but you're trying to do it in an easy way that people will digest and not get intimidated as you're throwing all these things out. And there's no way, however much you prepare, I bet 20% of what you prepare actually said on air.
No, exactly. You just kind of got to wing it. You got to kind of figure out which file you go to in your brain quick when a question comes in. But, you know, the thing about wine is long form is always, you know, we got a long form article this past week, and I thought long form is still a very amazing way to teach people about wine, particularly if you want to read it. It took me 20 minutes to read the article, and I was like, wow, I'm going to spend 20 minutes reading this article. Like, TV and Instagram and like influencing people happens on many different communication levels. So you can go long form, you can go radio, you can go TV, you can, what we're doing is we're talking to people where they're at. And this comes down to how you really design a reputation, but then also just design something that people want because you're listening to the audience, trying to be where they are.
How's 2026 looking? And it's early, and the weather's been cold and wet and crap, but this is May 12th. What's for your wines, what's on the horizon over the next year or so for the wine that you guys are making?
Well, I really love our portfolio right now. It has the Chardonnay, which is almost sold out, so I'd like to find a replacement white. And I have my eyes on a couple different varietals, but we don't grow a lot of them here. So Chardonnays and Gamay and Pinot are obviously really our heartbeat grapes here. So they're being more incredibly hard to find. So we're going to have to be creative. So I think the next part of our portfolio, even though maybe we started classically, some classic grapes, is moving into maybe a little bit more creativity and understanding. Maybe you'll try an Aligoté. Maybe you'll try something else. I mean, I'm really, you know, there's a lot of, it depends on what's available. If we get a really great grower come to us and say, hey, we've got one ton of this, what are we going to do with it? And then we're working on maybe the winemaking. What do we want the winemaking to be? You know, these are pretty classical interpretations to me in general of some of the best of the world have been able to taste wines all over the world. So when we're making something, it's, you know, the rosé is against Provence, the Riesling's against VDP, the Gamay is against Beaujolais Cru, the Cab Franc is against Loire. So we're defining, we're making grapes that are infinitely copycats, if you will, of the best wines in the world. But that doesn't always need to be what we are. So I'm going to say creativity is going to lead itself over the next couple of years of figuring out maybe some new fun ways to define wine, describe wine, and be a VQA or non-VQA wine. Who knows? I don't know.
And the interesting thing is just the flexibility. I can talk to JP Grew at Stratus. And he knows the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be these grapes. That might be the little side projects. And, you know, there's certain standards they're trying to hit.
Yeah.
But for you, it might be, as you said, Aligoté, because of someone made it really well. There's grapes available. And then you can take it to crush and make something yummy. I think Chateau de Charme does an Aligoté.
Yes.
That's one of the few I know that does that. So for you, you have this flexibility and also this mystery of you don't know what 2027 is going to be.
No, I don't know the fruit. I don't have the fruit. I'm sourcing the fruit. I'm finding friends in the world of fruit, and then also being creative and figuring out what's going on in the world. Still being relevant in a global context, I think, is one of the missing links that Ontario hasn't quite, not all of us have grasped yet, is that we compete against on a global stage. We compete on a global stage. So, you know, whatever we're making has to be relevant all over the world. And I always encourage winemakers and people in tasting rooms, like, you have to travel. If you don't travel and taste wine outside of just sitting at home in your dining room, like, wine just means more to you, and you'll taste more and you'll learn more when you're actually in a space. When you're standing in the Moselle, you're standing in Bordeaux, you're standing in Beaujolais, when you're standing at the edge of Provence, you know, and you're like, wow, this is like fantastical. It really is a magical place to be, and that's how you learn, I think.
And if you're in Provence, make sure to get the Mouvedre from Bandol.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so good.
Visit Tampier.
Meaty, beautiful wine. So as we end this, and again, we are at 3201 King Street in Vineland, the Crush on King. What do you hope by 2 days after Canadian Thanksgiving? So you've got the summer, the first part of the fall. What are you hoping for this space between now and then?
The future view, if we could predict the future. You know, we've put a lot of time and effort into the refresh. So our tasting room has been redesigned. We have tables that look beautiful, white marble tables. We have a wonderful staff that's going to teach you about, have a wine bar experience outside of your home. Bring your friends in here. You know, call us, make a reservation, and we can plan for you. I think that's the other thing I'd love people to maybe just figure out. Is like, we have a very small tasting room. We fit 18 people, you know, comfortably. So for us to have 6 people or 80 of your friends, give us a call, we can set something up. But I would like to see this, the Crush, be a buzz and a hub for people who love art and wine, people who love great wine, people who want to come in, taste wine, and then buy wine, who people want to support their neighbors, their winemakers. You look at Adam. Adam is a collaborative winemaker from all of the work he does for various virtual wineries. You look at Graham Rennie, who started virtually, now has bought a winery. I mean, the guy is, you know, I call him, he's kind of like a bit of a godfather in the wine business right now. He's really nice to have around, and he's here a lot of the time and has high standards for what we are going to become. And I also like that because we need to push our industry forward. So after harvest, our team is going to be very tired. I know our production team is going to be very tired. Our retail team hopefully is a bit refreshed. Maybe we've had a busy summer. But we're looking at growing. We want people to come in here. I want people to come in here. I want people to feel good, taste great wine, and we want to increase traffic to the winery. So please come and see us. Tell them Ange sent you. You get a free glass of rosé, I swear. Just come on in and taste the wines and see who we are.
It's like a promo code. Ange sent me.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you do get that free glass of rosé, hopefully it's from the Juice Wine Company, because that was a damn good rosé.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Angela, it's been way too long. Thrilled to be able to sit down with you. Congrats again on all your success and just building up your brand, your identity, and all the different work you do. And now you're making your own wine, and it's going to be the LCBO, and you're helping to spearhead just this incredible wine bar in Vineland. Thanks so much for being on the pod.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me at Spotify, Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.